Welcome to Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth at the studios of KQED in San Francisco. Summer is peak travel season in the U.S., and while jetting across the country via airplane is now commonplace, for most of us, travel still means hitting the road. AAA says more than 38 million people traveled by car over the Memorial Day weekend this year. An estimated 47 million were expected to travel around Independence Day. It's likely you take for granted the roads that get you from point A to point B, but the nation's complex highway network, from simple two-lane blacktop to mighty expressways, wasn't always that way. There was a time, not all that long ago, in which roads mainly existed as plans on paper. The story of how we got from then to now is told in Earl Swift's book, The Big Roads. Earl joins me via phone from all the way back across the continent in Virginia. Earl, welcome.
Hey, thanks so much.
Well, thank you for joining us. I wanted to get us into this from the experience that you had not all that long ago, the experience that inspired the book. You took your daughter and one of her friends on a cross-country road trip with the express purpose of avoiding the interstate highways. And so how did that get you thinking a little differently about the story of these roads?
Well, it wasn't expressly to avoid the interstates. It was expressly to drive the Lincoln Highway, which is a mostly two-lane early attempt at a coast-to-coast motor road, the first in the United States. It was laid out in 1913. And I thought my daughter, who was in sixth grade at the time, she's quite a bit older now, would benefit from seeing the U.S. In a way that you know most of us have forgotten to see it, which is one small town at a time, and to see the changing landscape kind of unroll around us, to be able to drive at low enough speed so we could have the windows down and smell the tar on the the hot tar of the road as we drove it. And what it told me, Brandon, was that it's a slow way to travel. The two lane old U.S. highway, the Lincoln follows U.S. 30 for most of its lanes. Was a wonderful innovation when it came along in the early to mid 20s, but I found that my 21st century patience was not quite up to dealing with it. At least wouldn't be on a daily basis. I've become spoiled by the interstates, as have most of us, I think.
Well, before our modern notion of highway travel was born, and this steps back to the early years of the 20th century, what was automobile travel like? Let's create that contrast from the spoiling of the interstates and our modern highways. What would that experience have been like for a motorist in the early years of the 1900s?
Let's look at 1900 specifically. First of all, it was dangerous. The fatality rate attributable to automobile travel was about 30 times what it is today. And that's all the more remarkable because there were only 8,000 registered motor vehicles in the United States. It was just traveling anywhere was messy. And, because there were only 8,000 cars and trucks, the vast majority of people got around by horse. And we're talking short pieces of travel here. For overland trips, they, of course, took the train. But in New York City alone in 1900, horses deposited 2.5 million pounds of manure on the streets every day. To translate that into to terms that might be more graspable, that's about 400,000 tons a year, or enough to float three Nimitz nuclear-powered aircraft carriers, three of the Navy's biggest, and a half dozen destroyers along with it. It was slow. It was balky. You had to be a mechanic as much as a driver. Rare was the outing by automobile that didn't end with a pop tire at the least, or a mechanical failure more often. And so you had to be able to get up, under your Oldsmobile and fix it if you wanted to get home. And the roads of the day were just mud wallows after a rain. There was nothing paved in the sense that we understand pavement in 1900. I think there were, by 1909, there were only 9 miles of concrete highway in the United States. So the vast majority of roads were unimproved dirt. A few of the better ones were gravel or a clay sand mix. But mostly we just drove around in mud.
And not for very long. I think you've written in, very evocatively in your book that, you might have cobblestone streets or something that resembled a kind of pavement within the major cities, but it didn't take you very long getting past the city limits to start running into much more treacherous and harder going.
Oh, as soon as you got out to the outer edge of the business district, the cobblestone fell away, and you wound up driving rutted wagon trail pretty much for the rest of the way out, and that devolved further. Henry Joy, who was the president of Packard, took his company's cars on expeditions out west early in the 20th century, and he'd take 3-4 weeks at a time to make these overland journeys, and he talks about getting to Omaha and asking the people at the Packard dealership there, where do I go from here? I'm headed to San Francisco. What roads do I follow to go west? And being told there are no roads. And so what he wound up doing was driving in the wagon tracks of essentially the settlers used the Oregon Trail and the Mormon Trail. And as he drove west, he carried wire cutters with him, and he'd clip his way through barbed wire fence that he encountered on the prairie and keep going. And around him would be the broken wheels and chassis of Conestoga wagons that had fallen by the wayside, 60 years before. So it's
man,
all
what
of,
a visual.
All of what we enjoy today is surprisingly recent. We got the numbered U.S. highway system in the mid-20s. We got the interstates approved in the mid-40s, but construction didn't start until a decade later. And that wasn't completed. The original system wasn't completed until 1992. So all of this is just yesterday.
It stands to reason that part of this would be economic in that great capitalist sense that as cars become more popular, people buy them, you want to have better roads on which to drive them. So part of this must have been commercial. But there were a few key figures early in the story that really brought the issue to the front burner, that really made it a little more front page than just people buying cars. One of them was Carl Fisher, whom you write about. What was his role in jump-starting what was called the Good Roads Movement of that era?
It might be surprising to learn that cars had little to do with the formation of the Good Roads Movement, and Fisher was involved in it from the beginning. He sold bicycles. He was a bicycle racer initially. And the first real push for good roads in the United States back in the 1890s was from bicyclists who found that they had nowhere to ride. And you got to understand just how powerful the national craze for bicycles was at the time. Beginning in the mid-1880s or so, running through the end of the century, it was a serious coast-to-coast passion. And, bicycles were improving by the year. And one thing that wasn't keeping up was surfaces on which you could ride them without shaking yourself to bits. And so Fisher initially began his push for better roads as first a rider of bikes and then as a dealer in bikes. He opened a bicycle shop in Indianapolis that became very successful. And then towards 1900, he began to chafe a little at the low speeds that a bicycle could achieve, and he always had a bit of a speed demon in him. So he bought a very early French automobile, and reputedly the first car in Indiana, and took up car racing, and eventually opened the first dealership in Indianapolis. And in that role, became an even more strident proponent, now not of just good road surfaces, but of highways that connected pieces of the country to each other. He was no longer content to just talk about, give me something to ride around, a place I can ride around town. He wanted to be able to take his car out on the open road and travel scores, if not hundreds of miles, on modern stone highway. And so in 1913, Fisher gathered a bunch of his automotive friends. He had a bunch of friends in the automotive industry, because by this time he was not only a dealer, but he made the most successful automobile headlight of the day, which ran on acetylene. He gathered them together at a dinner in Indianapolis and proposed the nation's first coast-to-coast rock highway, which was later renamed the Lincoln Highway. And that's the road my daughter and I traveled.
Right. And here gets to an interesting point, that the earliest, what we might consider modern predecessors of our highways today, were privately funded by interest groups, philanthropists or businessmen that would get together, form a committee, and build a highway that was named usually after some figure or some element of geography. The Lincoln Highway, you've already mentioned. Two of these routes, the Dixie Highway and the Lee Highway, ran through Knoxville. The Dixie-Lee Junction, in fact, on the Knox-Loudoun County line, still bears those names. But the auto clubs and the privately funded roads that they paid for had a pretty short lifespan, as it turned out. They were seminal, but they didn't last very long.
Well, they did kind of in a ghost form, because what happened was that when Fisher created the Lincoln Highway and set up a kind of a national fundraising campaign to build it, he inspired a bunch of copycats around the country. And a lot of these auto clubs were municipally based. They were founded in towns that wanted to be sure that they would be on a highway. And so they'd create a highway that happened to include their town. And you see that time and again. And you mentioned the Lee and the Dixie. A lot of the highway names that we've come in to disparage because they might have a Confederate bias to them date to that period. They were auto trail names. And the Lee Highway, of course, US 11 being a big one.
Mm-hmm.
The Dixie Highway follows a bunch of different numbers, so it's hard to identify that as having a successor highway. Anyway, in by the mid-20s, what had happened was that you had an anarchic jumble of privately built, maintained, and marketed highways around the United States, most of them dirt, most of them extremely primitive, some of them existing only as abstractions. But if you were to look at a map of the auto trail system, you'd notice some similarities to what we have today, because when the federal government decided, look, we've got to take highways out of the hands of the private sector and get some rational sense made out of this tangle of highways, they used the existing auto trails as the basis for the numbered U.S. highway system. And so in 1925, 1926, you saw the federal government attach numbers to pieces of what had been auto trail and build a grid that made a lot of sense, and that the feds would, the feds and states would now control. And you saw gradually most of those old auto trail names fall by the wayside.
You bring up an interesting point, which is that there were some significant questions early on, because this is when the highway system was being invented. Who would be in charge of publicly funded highways? Was this going to be a state matter, a federal matter? How was that issue resolved?
Well, it took years and years. That was a struggle that initially was addressed in 1916 with the Federal Aid Highway Act that year. And what the Federal Aid Highway Act of 16 said was that the federal government will partner with the states to put together government-financed highways, and it will basically leave it to the states where those highways will go. So each state retained autonomy over the routing and style of construction of the highways within its border. What you see developing, though, was the states had so much autonomy that there was no guarantee that an east-west state running through Tennessee would connect with an east-west state running through North Carolina. And so over time, thinking changed. The feds, some in the argument very much wanted to see the federal government assume control of interstate highways, or what were called interstate highways then, the numbered highways and the auto trails. And then you had another contingent that wanted all of the control to be in the hands of the states. And what we got was the 1921 Federal Aid Highway Act, which again, gave autonomy to the states, but gave the federal government an oversight role. If the feds were going to kick in money towards a highway, it would have to meet certain standards, and it would have to make sense in the greater context, the interstate context. And really, that 1921 Act laid the groundwork for all the federal-state cooperation since, and ultimately gave us the interstate highway system 30 years later.
Just ahead, more with Earl Swift, author of The Big Roads. We'll talk about the development of the interstate highway system. And later in the hour, what happened when residents of Memphis and Nashville decided they wanted a say in where Interstate 40 would be located. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue continues from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth at NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. Our topic today, the story of the nation's highways and byways. Our guest is Earl Swift, author of the book The Big Roads. Well, when we left off, Earl, we had just figured out who was going to be in charge of the highway system, how it was going to be paid for. There's an important person we need to insert into this discussion at this point, named Thomas McDonald. You could not invent a man more different than Carl Fisher if you tried, but he was just as critical, if not more so, to the story of how highways came to be. Tell us a little bit about the chief.
Well, Carl Fisher, whom we talked about a few minutes ago, was a real P.T. Barnum character. He was a showman. The press loved him. He was a walking quote machine. And Thomas Harris McDonald was, as you suggest, the opposite. He was a taciturn, rarely smiling technocrat who grew up in Iowa, was the first highway engineer in Iowa, and then was drafted to become the chief of the Bureau of Public Roads in 1919, and held that job until 1953. So he, in his 34 years in the federal government, was more or less the J. Edgar Hoover of road building. He served six presidents. He seemed that he would remain a fixture there until he dropped dead. He did eventually get let go by President Eisenhower. But before that happened, he was responsible more than anyone for taking Carl Fisher's, the primitive web of auto trails inspired by Carl Fisher, and converting it into a rational system of numbered highways. And then he launched in the 1920s a systematic study that stretched over the course of a dozen years or so of American highway and driving habits, highway needs, that produced a wealth of data and ultimately led to the development of the interstate highway system. And the interstate highway system we tend to think of as a product of the 1950s. McDonald and his leadership team actually devised most of the details of that system, including its routing, in the mid-1930s. Certainly by 1939, when they produced a study called Toll Roads and Free Roads that laid out a very rough blueprint of what we have today, 1939. So it was, we're talking 80 years ago that this was done. McDonald was a...
This points out... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, he was empirical in his thinking. He was not someone who would get out ahead of a problem. So he lacked the imagination and the vision of a Carl Fisher, but he was an excellent problem solver, an engineer's engineer. And if you wonder why our highways always seem to lag behind our traffic problems, really he was kind of the start of that. It was because he needed to see a need before he would come up with a solution that we became so empirically based in our highway building.
I wanted to jump in there and say, because you created this date for us, 1939, and I think Congress approved the concept of an interstate limited access expressway type system that we think of like the interstates today in the 1940s. So, of course, this goes counter to what many of our listeners may understand. We get the story about Dwight Eisenhower being the father of the interstate highway system, and the story usually has a few variations, but it typically goes that he was a young Army officer, 1919, he was assigned to go on a cross-country caravan, and the roads were so poor, the going so difficult, that he never forgot it, and then later resolved, you know, as president to do something about it. Your book says that's not really how the interstate system came to be. So we had this report in 1939. Congress began to sign off on it in the 40s. What was Eisenhower's role in the development of the country's highway network? What credit do you think he fairly deserves?
Well, he was a cheerleader, certainly. You know, you have the blueprint developed in 1939 by these technocrats. You have Congress approve the concept, the actual system, based on another report that Thomas McDonald and his men put together in 1944. And at that point, Dwight Eisenhower had bigger fish to fry. He was, you know, leading the Allied advance across Western Europe. It was long after, the interstates were all but a done deal except for funding, that he even decided to go into politics. Cheerleader is about the best you can give him. He came into the presidency unaware that all of this work had been done, and apparently uninformed by his people that all of this work had been done. And pressed Congress to develop a system of interstate highways, and as he envisioned it, it would be very much like the autobahns. It would not go into American cities. It would, you would have a grid, an interstate grid, that would connect ring roads around the cities, but not penetrate into them. So that's what he came into office envisioning. It's certainly not what we got, and it's not what the interstate highway system was intended to be by the people who actually devised the planning for the system. It was always an urban, and this runs counter to popular imagination as well. It was envisioned as an urban problem solver first, and then a connector of cities and regions second.
That points out a basic divide that developed, and I think this may have applied to when the U.S. highways, the numbered highways, were being planned in the 20s and 30s. Who were we trying to serve? Are we trying to move people around cities, through cities? Is it farm to market? There was a real debate about who the audience was for these massive highways, right?
Well, there wasn't among the people who actually put the system together. Early on, the first people to really embrace the automobile in great numbers were farmers. They solved so many problems for farmers in terms of getting product to market. Just getting product to the train station was suddenly simplified to an almost unimaginable degree. In the early days of the automobile, you saw a hunger for rural mileage that competed with that for urban and interurban. But as the automobile became more popular, it became more of a plaything, and people wanted to adventure more in it, and they saw, overland travel as something within their grasp, following no one else's schedule but their own. You really see the network taken out of the hands of simple farm-to-market needs and placed in catering more to the urban automobile user. By the time the interstates came along, it was clearly intended to relieve what had already become just stultifying traffic in the cities. And we complain about traffic in some cities of the country now, but it is kid stuff compared to what we dealt with in the late 1930s. At the time of the 1939 New York World's Fair, traffic jams would keep you locked up for hours around that city and in Boston, and in a half dozen other metropolitan areas in the country. It was brutal. These cities were, for the most part, They started as colonial towns. Their road systems dated to the horse and buggy. They were never intended to accommodate parking, let alone, you know, just car travel. And they clogged up. They clogged up terribly. So the interstate system was, you know, certainly Eisenhower and others since him have seen it as unfortunate because it did go into the cities, and it did, you know, there was a lot of collateral damage along the way. When you take a 300-foot right-of-way and you jam it through a densely settled old town, there are going to be people who get shoved aside, and a lot of them. But the fact is that was the single greatest need for expressways that we had as a nation at that time. And McDonald and company were, they were bent on getting that solved first. And then you would, you know, part of that solution would have a series of radial highways extending from the downtown of every major city. And eventually those radials would connect with the radials from other cities. And that's how you would build an interstate, you know, interregional network.
Well, you foreshadowed this in your comment about the collateral damage of an interstate, especially in an urban area. So I want to jump to that because that'll be the theme for our final segment today. But for decades, highway planners and engineers were used to getting pretty much what they wanted. The highways were built in areas where planners like Thomas McDonald and others thought they'd be most logical. That did not take into account whether or not people wanted to sell their homes, whether they wanted their neighborhoods disturbed, whether they wanted anything to do with progress as it was defined. That began to change in a big way as the interstates began to make more leeway, more and more inroads into the major urban areas in this country.
It sure did, yeah. And it did not take long. The first place you see it really develop is in San Francisco, where the Embarcadero Freeway crossed, shadowed the waterfront and passed within just a few feet of the ferry building. If you look at, it's always fun to look at an old Clint Eastwood movie other movies from the 60s that are San Francisco based, to see that they invariably show the Embarcadero Freeway, and it was an eyesore to end all eyesores, this 51-foot brutalist concrete structure that blocked out any view of the water from a city with the most beautiful water view in the country. It made no sense. But if you're a highway engineer and you're just looking at where to route an expressway, and you're doing it strictly by map and by property value, well, then a bunch of abandoned wharves on the waterfront make a perfect place. You know, you're not going to displace many people if you drive your highway through that. Anyway, the Embarcadero Freeway sparked the freeway revolt in the late 1950s in San Francisco, and it resulted in that city today having very little interstate penetration at all. They basically told the California Department of Transportation that they wanted no part of their big plans for expressways in their town. And the Embarcadero Freeway was halted before it was completed. So not only was it ugly, it really served no purpose whatsoever. It became completely pointless and was finally torn down in the 90s after an earthquake in the late 80s damaged it beyond repair. You see that sort of thing repeated over and over. In the vast majority of places, the revolt was founded on the realization that highway planners had driven their right-of-ways through low-income neighborhoods, displacing an inordinate share of black residents. You saw that in D.C., the plans for the highways there, certainly in Baltimore, pretty much every urban area in the country. And in some cities, the populations were able to mount very effective protests. Baltimore's lasted the better part of 40 years, but they finally got the plan stopped. Had they not, a highway would have gone right over the top of the inner harbor. It would have driven right through most of the west side of town, displacing tens of thousands of people. It would have erased Baltimore and the parts that we find charming today.
Well, there's so much, obviously, to talk about in cities. This was mirrored in cities across the country, some larger, some smaller. We'll get to that in the final segment of our program today. Earl Swift, author of The Big Roads, thank you so much for your time today.
You bet. It's been a pleasure, Brandon.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. And we could do two or three more shows on this. There's so much more that we didn't get to, but I think that's a good starting point for us. Thanks also to Jim Bennett at KQED, who's engineering our conversation today. We just talked about the roots of what were called the freeway revolts that broke out in many cities across America, including where I'm sitting in San Francisco. After the break, we're going to take a closer look at how that played out in Tennessee. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. In the spring of 1968, the day before Martin Luther King was killed, Memphis city leaders met behind closed doors to plan the final route of Interstate 40. At least, they thought it was the final route. The freeway's planned path cut right through Overton Park, a public green space that had been around for nearly 70 years by that point. A citizens group filed to block construction and force federal highway officials to pick another course. That lawsuit would be one of many blows dealt to the interstate system's habit of chewing through urban minority neighborhoods and other areas deemed of little value. Conservation manager Brooks Lamb is the author of a forthcoming book about Overton Park. He joins us from a studio in Nashville. Brooks, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Brandon. I'm really happy to be here.
Let's take a step back then to, this is more than 60 years ago at this point, to why that particular route was chosen. Interstate 40 was going to be built through Tennessee, a major regional and even national route. It goes from Wilmington, North Carolina, all the way out to California. Why this particular portion of the route through Memphis that would jeopardize Overton Park?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting reason, but one that's not all that surprising. So the parkland was actually already publicly owned and owned by government. And so actually, instead of having to condemn other properties and purchase new land and all those sorts of things, they already owned this 340 acres. And so that was going to be an easy target for them to actually save a little money, both federal and state funds. So I think that is one of the primary reasons that Overton Park was targeted. It was also chosen because they wanted to have the interstate running through Midtown Memphis and be able to really connect East Memphis to downtown, in addition to connecting people across the state and across the country through the interstate.
You know, early in the development of the interstate highway system, it was not unusual for the highway planners to get their way. They would come armed with statistics and route maps and say, this is the best path for engineering, for travel, for speed. This is what we want to do. And sometimes they would not be opposed on that. But toward the mid to late 1960s, we saw more public opposition developing across the country. This also happened in Memphis. A citizens group formed to protect Overton Park and specifically to oppose this route. What was significant about the park? Why did the group feel so strongly that it should be left intact or left alone?
Yeah, so this is my understanding for lots of different reasons that people have an attachment to a place. So people over time, when they build up this sense of imagination of a place, and I'm using some terms that are kind of coined by an environmental philosopher and writer and farmer, Wendell Berry from Kentucky, when people have an imagination of a place, they get to know it so well that helps them cultivate an affection for that place. And as it is with our friends, with our family, when we have affection for a place, we care about that place's well-being and we become good stewards of that place. And so people who were in the citizens group, Citizens to Preserve Overton Park, had nurtured that sense of affection with Overton Park. They grew up walking their dog in the park, or they grew up taking their kids to the playground, or they grew up just, you know, spending time there. And I think it was that time that they spent there and that sense of love that they had for a place that actually motivated them to do all that they could do to protect it.
As freeway opposition began to build in America's major cities, sometimes it was led by minority groups. I'm thinking specifically of Nashville, of Baltimore, and some other cities where primarily African-Americans would say, well, you're building this right through our neighborhood, but not the white neighborhood next door, and it's driving down property values, and it's forcing people out of our neighborhoods. And so there was a racial element to the opposition. Was the group, the Citizens to Protect Overton Park in Memphis, a fairly diverse group? Was it one kind of ethnicity or another, or was it sort of a multi-hued group that came together for this park?
You know, as far as the exact compilation of the or composition of the group, you know, I'm not sure as far as all the different ethnicities, all the different races. I do know that this was a effort that was pursued by people of all different backgrounds. Now, whether they were actively involved in C-pop or not is one thing. I do think a lot of the people who were involved in the group were white. People of all different backgrounds were pushing for Overton Park to be preserved, and that's evident from several different sources, including a newspaper article in a prominent black newspaper, the Memphis World, that was published in the mid-60s, actually encouraging its readers, which was obviously a mostly African-American audience, to attend these meetings, talking about protecting the trees in Overton Park, protecting Overton Park in general, and encouraging people to actually get involved to do it. So through the media, through all kinds of different parts of the community, through both white and black and other minority and racial and ethnic groups, neighborhoods and things of that nature, there was a multi-pronged approach to try to save this place that was so valuable to so many different people.
Well, as you said, the opposition began in the late 50s, and of course, in the justice system and in trying to sort out especially complicated cases, things take a lot of time. The group filed its first suit to block the interstate in 1969, about a decade later, and work continued on Interstate 40 through this whole period as the case was being sorted out. The highway planners kind of just kept on going with the expectation they were going to be allowed to continue. So that by the time the Supreme Court ruled, and this was in March of 1971, the bulldozers were basically at the park's doorstep. They had come all the way up to the boundary.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and it's really interesting, as you mentioned, how long this kind of process takes to develop. So in the interim period between, you know, 56 or 57 and the filing of suit in 69 and the Supreme Court case in 71, CPOP is, you know, making T-shirts, they're passing out flyers, they're attending public meetings, and all of those different kind of things. But yeah, eventually towards the end of the 60s, you know, as bulldozers actually get right next to the park, I mean, if you're going into Memphis from Nashville or from anywhere east of the city on I-40 today, Sam Cooper Boulevard actually runs right up to the edge of Overton Park, and it looks as if it's meant to continue through the park and out the other side. So they were literally right there, just ready to go. So it is amazing how close it became to actually destroying the place, and how important the legal battle was in actually halting that, because as I'd kind of alluded to earlier, there were 10 years or so of fighting, and until they were actually able to get some legal ammunition and some things with some real teeth to it, there wasn't much hope of actually stopping the government from doing this.
The fight over Interstate 40 in Memphis continued even after that 1971 Supreme Court ruling, because over the next decade, state and federal highway planners continued to propose alternate plans, including building I-40 once at under Overton Park in a tunnel, or sunken in a deep trench, hidden somewhat from view. And yeah, we want to be good stewards, good neighbors. We're still going to build the interstate through your park, but maybe we could put it underground or something. Obviously, those proposals didn't go anywhere. So what made highway planners finally abandon the plan for Overton Park entirely and decide to go around the city?
Sure, yeah. And I do think it's important to mention, at least briefly, the Department of Transportation Act of 1966, there's actually a section in that, a very small section, Section 4F. If an interstate or anything with public funds used for highway development is going to destroy a public park or other, you know, historically important land, they have to have studies done of feasible and prudent alternatives. And the main issue around all these different routes being proposed, as you mentioned, tunnels under the park, trenches and all these different kind of things, the government was essentially trying to say that, well, we're giving you alternatives, but these aren't feasible and prudent, so just let us go ahead and do what we intended to do anyway. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, it was actually as Charlie Newman, who I interviewed for my book, who was the attorney for CPOP in Memphis, as he mentions, if the state and federal government had actually done a good job and had gone in good faith trying to propose alternative routes, they might have actually been able to build a highway, if not through Overton Park, then still through Midtown. They could have, but instead they focused on proposing these alternatives, as you've already mentioned, tunneling under the park, or going through an area of Memphis that would actually destroy an orphanage, several prominent homes, the federal judge's house, and all these different kind of things, just proposing these things that were absolutely ridiculous hoping that they would just be able to build through the park. And eventually, I think it just kind of came to a head of frustration and saying, okay, you know, we give in. And that was in the 80s, and they just decided to go ahead and route north of the city, which upset some people, I believe, in East Memphis, wanting a quicker route to downtown. But yeah, they finally just decided to go north and to leave Overton Park alone, to leave Midtown alone, and just find a different route.
Conservation manager Brooks Lamb is the author of a forthcoming book about Overton Park. That's scheduled for publication later this year. He joined us from a studio in Nashville. Brooks, thank you so much for joining us on Dialogue today.
Thanks, Brandon. I really appreciate it.
In Nashville, opposition to the planned path of Interstate 40 was led by Black community members because it was predominantly Black neighborhoods targeted for demolition. Unlike the effort in Memphis, which sought to preserve a park, the group known as the I-40 Steering Committee argued against the interstate's proposed path on cultural, social, and economic grounds. Also, unlike Memphis, the steering committee's attempt to reroute the highway was unsuccessful. Wayne Moore is Tennessee's assistant state archivist. He's been researching how interstate highways affected the state's urban areas. What did the federal and state highway officials say in defense of the proposed route? What was their justification for putting 40, at least on paper, on the areas they wanted to put it?
The interesting thing is that initially the route was different. It went a little further south along Charlotte Avenue, which was then and still is today a major business thoroughfare, lots of small businesses along Charlotte going west from downtown. And that's where the preliminary study had routed the interstate. But those were largely white-owned small businesses, and it was only a little bit later in the 60s that they shifted it north along what was the main thoroughfare through the historic Black community in North Nashville, Jefferson Street, and it was kind of famous for all kinds of small businesses, including a lot of music clubs. Jimi Hendrix had played on Jefferson Street in some of those clubs just before going to England and making it very big. But so that was kind of the main avenue of Black business in Nashville, was that Jefferson Street corridor. And when they shifted the interstate onto that, even though they said they were doing it, you know, to preserve those businesses, they actually ended up destroying quite a few more businesses. It's just they were Black-owned instead of white-owned businesses, as well as a lot of residences as well.
And tell me about the I-40 Steering Committee. Who was in it? What was their case in opposition to the interstate?
The I-40 Steering Committee was formed in 1967, and it was composed largely of prominent individuals from the Black community centered on Jefferson Street. Their attorney was Avon Williams, Jr., who was very important in the civil rights movement here in Tennessee, and he was an associate of Thurgood Marshall's. They had litigated several important cases together. And he was the lead attorney on that. They sued the state of Tennessee in U.S. District Court for a lack of public hearings on where the interstate would run, and alleging, of course, that there was racial discrimination in the choice of that interstate highway path. And, you know, their contention was, well, if you want to save businesses and residences, this is the wrong way to go, because it actually ended up demolishing 128 businesses and relocating a large percentage of those African American owned firms in Nashville, almost 80%. So that was their contention, but they were ultimately not successful.
Some of the residents of Nashville that were affected by the construction of Interstate 40 got a double whammy. There was a neighborhood called Edge Hill near Fort Negley, toward the south side of town, that was bisected by the interstate. Then some of the residents who relocated to that other neighborhood, Jefferson Street, you were just talking about, ended up having to move again when the interstate was routed through that part of town.
Yeah, that was a double whammy. Since Interstate 65, the north-south corridor was done a little bit later, many of those people who were in Edgehill that were affected by I-65.
So the lawsuit was filed by the I-40 Steering Committee, this coalition of black leaders and business owners in that area, to stop the construction or at least to reroute Interstate 40 through parts of town. What was the outcome there?
Ultimately, that suit was unsuccessful in district court. I think they were able to appeal it up one level. Both courts, district and the Court of Appeals, sided with the state of Tennessee, and they were unable to have it heard at the Supreme Court level. So it went forward, and you know, a lot of that very vibrant black-owned business community along Jefferson Avenue became a thing of the past. Then not only were those existing businesses and residences displaced, but the African-American neighborhood was bisected. It was cut in half, and the interstate became kind of a barrier. That's the way it is today in Nashville.
Why do you think the suit failed? And I don't necessarily mean a legal argument, but I've read in some of the analysis of these freeway opposition movements in Memphis and Nashville that to compare the two, the one in Nashville was relatively late to the game, maybe didn't have the grassroots support, it hadn't had time to send its message. What were some of the areas where you think there was a weakness that may have contributed to what happened?
It could be that it just got started too late. These are big infrastructure projects that had been pending since the mid-1950s, and it was almost 1970 before this lawsuit got underway.
Wayne Moore is the Assistant State Archivist at the Tennessee State Library and Archives. He joined us on the phone from his office in Nashville. Mr. Moore, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Brandon. Thank you.
Thanks also to the guests you heard earlier in the broadcast, Environmental Manager Brooks Lamb and Earl Swift, author of The Big Roads. Greg Hill is our producer, holding down the fort back in Knoxville. Special thanks today to KQED in San Francisco, especially Operations Manager Monte Carlos. He made this audio connection possible. Dialogue is a production of WUOT News. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth in San Francisco.